first and foremost, I think election observer missions provide confidence to the citizenry, right? They know that the world is watching. And when international observer missions come, of course, that comes with, you know, media attention, because the media, both domestically and internationally, want to cover what seems to be a big story. And when you have media on the ground, that also gives people confidence that, you know, I might queue in line for 10, 12 hours to vote, and at the end of the day, is it going to count? And I think these sorts of efforts really provide confidence to citizens that their votes will count, they will matter, and their voices will be heard.
Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Ongokulu, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are, and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So, without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel, and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. Okay. What are we talking about today? Election observer missions. So the Brentas Foundation recently sent a 32-person delegation accredited by the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, IEBC, and which included political leaders and policymakers from around Africa, to Kenya from the 5th to the 11th of August. The group was spread out, you know, across Nairobi, Mombasa, Kisumu, and Wazingishu, largely Eldoret, for a lot of the voting day activities. And one may ask why, or at least I would ask that question, why are we doing this? Why are we involved in this space? And I'll tell you now, I'm sort of using the Kenya a case in point. So Kenya, with its population of some 50 million people, is a big player on the continent in terms of growth, in terms of advancement and economic contribution, GDP-wise. There's a lot to be learned from Kenya. A part of what we do at the Brentas Foundation is to identify and share best practices, right? So by supporting Kenya's democratic electoral process, we're doing a number of things, in my opinion. The first is providing a presence to safeguard a process that Kenyans chose as a form of governance, and to help ensure that it's done in a manner that's perceived to be at least free and fair as far as can be ascertained. And the second would be bringing others closer, right, to learn how things are done and also not done. And that's a lot of what we did with, as you see, as a part of our group, is a lot of sort of pro-democracy but opposition leaders across the continent. The third point I would mention is this idea of building the repertoire of the lessons of best practices, which can strengthen other democratic institutions across the continent in a lot of the work that we do. So that's kind of the basis around going into election observation in Kenya, and as we've done in other places like Somaliland in the past, and I believe Lesotho a couple years ago. I'll tell you what, for me, it was amazing to be in Kenya on election day to witness the enthusiasm and energy for this democratic process. For those of us with limited living memory of the struggles of and for independence, and yet major beneficiaries of this, it felt like a transfer of institutional memory of sorts, a reminder that, you know, we make up government, that we get to choose, we get to decide, and above all, we get to fire. So for as long as we decide to stick to this governance model, we must fully participate. And I think a lot of the conversations I've had in the past, in the recent past, reflect this new way of sort of, not new way of thinking, but this renewal for me as an individual. And I hope other young people like myself who are looking to chart a career path in the space of growth and development for African countries. On the other end, it was, of course, an absolute honor and privilege to participate in this observer mission together with some of the continent's most dynamic leaders, past and present, and friends, a lot of who inspire the journey, my journey to be more, to do more, simply because I can. So anyway, now that's probably the longest introduction that I've done into an episode. So let's not waste too much time. Today joining me is Jeffrey Smith. Jeffrey is Twitter famous for good and for country, is the best way to put that. Jeffrey Smith is a human rights campaigner, a social media influencer, writer, and consultant. who has advised several presidents and pro-democracy opposition leaders from over a dozen African countries. He has over a decade of experience building democracy promotion and advocacy campaigns. Jeff is also the co-creator, producer, and often a co-host of The Resistance Bureau. You should look it up. It's a live format program that spotlights, you know, emergent issues and the leaders at the forefront of the struggles for democracy and freedom. And oh, Jeff is also the founding director of Vanguard Africa, an organization that represents the synthesis of best practices in campaign management, strategic communications, and public advocacy with the mission-driven focus of a pro-democracy organization. He's done a lot, and today he's here to talk a bit about election observer missions. What's the point, and are they important? I think these are the types of conversation I like to have, so you get to be a fly on the wall. Let's listen into the chat with Jeffrey Smith.
Well, Jeff, thanks so much for joining me here today. I would have thought you'd be sick of me after Kenya, but alas, here we are again. So how have you been since I last saw you?
Very well. Just really thinking back about our time in Kenya and the electoral process and what a humbling and amazing experience it was to witness, especially waking up early on election day and seeing you know, the streets already lined with voters jubilant to go and exercise their democratic rights. And it made me really think, and I'm still thinking a lot about how I wish Americans back home, you know, enjoyed the same sort of excitement and enthusiasm for voting and choosing our own leaders. But, you know, that's something we certainly have to work on here. And I think it's something we can definitely learn from our brothers and sisters in Kenya and elsewhere across the globe that I've witnessed elections take place.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it really was something. I had the opportunity to see sort of the enthusiasm when we did this in Somaliland last year, was it? And it's just, it's always, you know, the excitement you see. And I remember people banging on the door saying, you have 15 minutes at like 5:45, yeah. Like letting them know they are not playing. They need to be in there at 6. And basically to see the doors just burst open and people running to be first in the queue. Like that was some experience. That's for sure. All right. Absolutely. So just as a background, we spent almost a week in Kenya as part of the Brentis Foundation Election Observer Mission. And today, Jeff is just joining me to explore some of the ideas behind, you know, when we think about election observer missions, what's the point? Why are they necessary? That's if we agree that they are. And I think that would make for a good chat. But before that, I'm a big, big fan of hearing people's stories. So Jeff, can you share a little bit about, you know, your decision into being in your current line of work? When did that happen? Why did you choose this path? And how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I love telling this story because, you know, I didn't happen upon this line of work by conscious choice initially. So I was actually, you know, I come from a very small farming town in New England. You know, I ultimately ended up being the first in my family to go to college, to get a passport, to travel abroad. So in many ways, I'm sort of the black sheep of my family. And when I was in college, I was actually a broadcasting major. So I was very interested in radio broadcasting and music and doing, you know, getting involved in that line of work. But as part of my general education requirements that we all have to take as undergraduate students in university in America, I took a course on international relations, and it was a course taught by an old American academic who had spent half his life in Mauritius. So it was a course on African politics and geopolitics, and I found it very interesting and fascinating learning about the history of Southern Africa, particularly in the liberation struggles there, and of course the fight against apartheid in South Africa. So it sort of, you know, really interested me, and I ultimately ended up volunteering at a local UNESCO office, which was on my university campus at the University of Connecticut. And through that experience, you know, I helped to put together a human rights conference with the staff there, and had the chance to meet Ahmed Kathrada, who was, as many who might be listening know, in South Africa and elsewhere, was an icon in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, spent over 2 decades on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela and other liberation struggle leaders, and we ultimately forged this friendship. And I my interest in the politics of South Africa, especially, you know, really went quite deep. And ultimately, long story short, at the end of 5 years as an undergraduate, I ended up with a major in political science and human rights. And interestingly, during that time as an undergraduate, I helped my professors and advisors at that time to actually create the human rights major at my university, which became the first multidisciplinary human rights major in the country at the University of Connecticut. And then went to grad school and further studied these issues, ended up going to South Africa, working at a think tank there for a while before coming to Washington, D.C., where I've been since 2009. So it was definitely not a linear path, and it was definitely forged and paved by the relationships I was able to make with people like Ahmed Kathrada and others who were, you know, really involved in the struggles for human dignity and freedom and human rights and democracy in Africa. So I'm so thankful to them, and that's ultimately why I'm here today and remain vested and interested in these sorts of issues.
No, that's a really good one. And thank you for sharing that. I'm curious, that's a very interesting journey. And if you're thinking back, right, on, you know, the number of years you spent in this space, what would you say is the, you know, the one thing that, I guess, let's say, surprised you the most about working or your current line of work? What has surprised you the most?
I guess what has surprised me the most more recently, so this is on the sort of the front of my mind, is how much we, and I'm speaking as an American here, how much we take for granted, you know, how much we take for granted our democratic rights and our civil liberties and the rights that we've had all our lives growing up and don't think twice about. But, you know, given the nature of my work and the partners that we have across Africa, especially, you know, most of them are coming from highly authoritarian, repressive environments in which they've been jailed, they've been tortured, they've been arrested multiple times simply for advocating for and pushing to secure the rights that we here in the West, and especially America, take for granted every day. And that's something I really try to impart on many of my friends and family who you know, don't necessarily, you know, take stock of or track developments across the world. I think in many ways we are held back by the notion of American exceptionalism, that we are somehow special and, you know, sequestered from the rest of the world. But what I have found through the past decade and a half working in this field is that we're all in this fight together. You know, the democratic backsliding and the attacks on democracy and democratic institutions we're seeing in America right now are not mutually exclusive from what we're seeing elsewhere across Africa. And for me, the lesson I've learned from that to sort of put an end point is that cross-border solidarity and cooperation is so incredibly important. You know, the fight for democracy here in America is not entirely separate from the fight for democracy in Zimbabwe or Uganda or other authoritarian countries in Africa. We're all really, you know, involved in this together. And in that way, I don't necessarily think boundaries are necessary. You know, I think we're all human at the end of the day, and we all have basic aspirations to have our voices heard and our votes matter and for our lives to be respected. And I think we're all bound together by that very simple notion. And that's something that guides my work every single day, every minute that I'm awake and doing this kind of work. That's what guides me personally.
No, thank you for that. And I think, you know, that brings us quite neatly into the chat for today, right? This idea of, you know, solidarity and cooperation and collaboration around advancing democracy. Every vote matters, and trying to protect that for most people. And I think the Brentes Foundation, as you know, is, you know, quite committed to this idea of strengthening the economic growth and performance of African countries. And a part of that, right, is through identifying and sharing some of these best practices. practices. Now, given you probably have heard Greg highlight this a couple of times, right? Given this sort of correlation, especially on the continent, between democratic conditions and long-term development, you know, we found it a worthy cause to engage on this front also, and thus hence to participate in things like the Somaliland elections and now our most recent one, Kenya. And so it really does align with this idea of, because I know sometimes it's like, well, it kind of is separate from what you're doing, but it's like, no, it's part and parcel of the whole process of strengthening economic performance, the kinds of conditions that allow these things to go further. So I just thought it was interesting. Absolutely. Now, I think just, yeah, to get us started, or I guess we've already started, but to get us going on this topic of, you know, observer missions, what would you say are some of the purposes of observer missions and how do they go about achieving them?
I think there are a number of different levels to the importance of observer missions. I think domestically, in my experience, you know, having been involved in elections in Africa and elsewhere, is that, you know, especially when you're working in countries that have had, let's say, a not so ideal history with democratic elections, holding democratic elections and having the results actually be legitimate. First and foremost, I think election observer missions provide confidence to the citizenry, right? They know that the world is watching. And when international observer missions come, of course, that comes with, you know, media attention, because the media, both domestically and internationally, want to cover what seems to be a big story. And when you have media on the ground, that also gives people confidence that, you know, I might queue in line for 10, 12 hours to vote, and at the end of the day, is it going to count? And I think these sorts of efforts really provide confidence to citizens that their votes will count, they will matter, and their voices will be heard at the end of the day. So in my experience, that's been so crucially important, is just empowering local citizens, letting them know that they are taking part in a sacred process that at the end of the day will ultimately matter, and their voices and their votes will be heard and counted. Secondly, I think on the international level, it's very important because, to my earlier point, it starts bringing small d Democrats together, right? And I think the Brenthurst Foundation is a great example of that. You know, bringing Democrats from across the world together, putting them in a country like Kenya, or you mentioned Somaliland. So building these alliances and networking and just, you know, having those relationships are so crucially important. It sounds so simple and so mundane, but going back to my earlier point, those sorts of relationships are what are exactly what's going to pave the way for greater transparency and accountability and democracy down the line in country after country. Because so often, again, small d Democrats worldwide, they often feel like they're working in isolation, that they're in a silo, right? That other people in other countries across the world aren't going through similar experiences. They aren't going through the similar struggles that they're having, but in fact they are. There are many people going through the same struggles, and there are so many lessons to be learned and so many relationships to be forged and built off of that to then strengthen the demand for democracy in Africa and also elsewhere. It helps hold leaders accountable and helps keep us as global citizens accountable. You know, it really energizes us to go out and exercise our rights. For instance, you know, coming back from Kenya, I'm more emboldened and more energized to vote here in the US and to hold my own elected leaders accountable. So I think it has that multiplier effect on the domestic level, the regional and international levels as well.
No, definitely. And I think, you know, I was like, I'm going to let Jeff go first to see if there are areas that we align. And I think you basically mentioned everything that I thought about, right? Is this idea, it's also, you know, you've mentioned this in other words, but it's also this sort of vote of camaraderie, right? To show exactly. that we care and that we stand with you, and we are looking to sort of help be not watchdogs per se, but to help ensure that the process is as free and fair as can be ascertained from observer missions like this. And also it's a chance to learn this idea of bringing together Democrats, right, from other countries. You get to see how others are conducting themselves and to learn from them, the good things that could be replicated, the bad things to watch out for and avoid, or try to think through to avoid, you know, making such mistakes. So there's just so many lessons from election observer missions. But I think I'm curious to hear your thoughts on one of the, criticisms that we often hear about election observer missions is one, you know, this idea that they are not there long enough. And then there's also the idea that, you know, sometimes in most places, elections are won or stolen before election day. So what difference does that make? And even that, even when observers are present, depending on what kinds of systems are used, elections can still be rigged. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how observer missions play into sort of these beliefs, these mainstream beliefs, and how even for missions like ours, missions for others, we saw so many of them. What are some of the things that we can be doing to improve ourselves? I don't know if you have any thoughts on those yet.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that certainly needs further interrogation from people who know more about this than me. But I think, you know, there are two standout recommendations that I think can certainly be made. You know, I think first and foremost, teams, election observer teams, need to be more active earlier in the process, if possible. Mm-hmm. You know, taking early assessments of the rules, identification requirements, and changes to electoral registers in advance of the vote, making those findings public. You know, it's not just about election day, right? We know this, of course, and we have our own mandates when we get to the country, and we can't do everything. And that's why it's important to have, you know, multiple observer missions in the country and working together and talking to each other. You know, I think that the safety of opposition candidates, their ability to campaign freely, and their access to state media are also crucial to ensuring a truly free and fair vote. And too often monitors overlook these baseline requirements, right? And, you know, all too often, I think this is changing a bit, but all too often, you know, observers who are in the country tend to overlook these issues, and they're often guided by their home government. So when governments or regional organizations send in their observers, oftentimes they're doing it and making pronouncements for the sake of ensuring quote unquote stability in the short term. Yeah. And I think that's where that laxity must end. Observers need to be ready to speak up loudly about these concerns in time to adequately fix them, or be prepared to openly question the vote's overall legitimacy if that is merited. So that's the first issue. I think secondly, like modern day police chasing cyber thieves instead of masked bank robbers, you know, I think international observers need to adapt to new technologies. That is very clear. And I think observers, if they can, and if they have it within their mandate and they have the resources to do so, you know, perhaps shift from people watching to data analysis, you know, tracking digital processes, using statistical tests like parallel vote tabulation to identify potential abnormalities, and conducting forensic audits on the final results. And for just to give one example, that's why the election last year in Zambia was so incredibly successful. I think you have to give credit to domestic institutions, of course, but the fact that there was, for instance, a robust parallel vote tabulation that was undertaken, it did not allow the incumbent president, Edgar Lungu, to say he won with any credibility. As we all remember, he tried to say that he won the election, he was going to stay on in power, but the data was there and the data proved that he lost. Very similarly to Gambia in December 2016, when Yahya Jammeh, that country's longtime dictator, tried to convince the world that he had won that election. But again, there were results from a PVT that was done unequivocally proving that he had lost, thereby ensuring a democratic transition to now President Adama Barrow. So in sum, I think adopting these more nuanced approaches, adding them to the existing mandates of observer missions will not only help to ensure credible and broadly acceptable elections, but it will also provide, you know, and this is important to me, and I would think to you too, much needed life support to sustain the faith that citizens have expressed in democratic processes in Africa. And in many ways, you know, the future of democracy, I don't want to put too much of an emphasis on it, but I think in many ways, that future, the future of democracy, is in the hands of election observers. But I think in order to take that mandate and really, you know, exercise that forcefully, they must accept, and we must accept, the need for some reforms. Otherwise, in some cases, they'll continue to be a part of a growing problem. In other words, endorsing otherwise extremely flawed election processes that, you know, have become all too common, not just in Africa, but across the world, at the hands of modern day authoritarians.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, you know, when as you were speaking, one thing that came to mind is, you know, two words that I've been hearing a lot of and in different versions, right? Voter apathy. And especially when it comes to the youth, we've heard these, you know, raised as conversation points, even around the Kenyan elections, that not as many youth showed up, but even in terms of voter turnout in general, right? Yeah. There are a few people involved. How, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, right? And I'm not sure if this is an area that you specifically research, but how do we reconcile, right, this idea that, you know, majority of Africans, at least according to the most recent Afrobarometer survey, prefer, you know, democracy as a form of governance, but then when it comes to a process like this, like elections, right, electoral processes, people aren't as keen, people aren't as excited to show up. And I can think of a thousand reasons why, a lot of which would be because they say the same things and they actually don't do it, so stop bothering me. But how do we reconcile these two things, and what does it mean for people like you, people who are doing work like yours, who are sort of pro-democracy and are trying to advocate for more substantive democracy in countries?
Yeah, so I think Kenya is a great example of what you've just been talking about. If you look at the data that has emerged since Election Day on August 9, just 40% of Kenyans under 35 were actually registered to vote in the election. And the 65% turnout that we saw on Election Day was sharply down from the 80% reported in Kenya's 2017 election. So, you know, for many, this is a rejection amongst the youth of what many saw as a bad choice mm-hmm. between candidates from Kenya's discredited political elite. So I think that is mm-hmm. certainly a concern going forward. But I think if you were to sort of broaden the scope outside of Kenya, you know, unfortunately, the continent does seem to be moving away from democracy. So that obviously begs the question, why is Africa, and this is obviously a very contentious issue and it's a bit provocative, but I think we have to ask ourselves and really interrogate this question, is why is Africa seeming to get more authoritarian even as it's getting younger? And I haven't really seen that answered in any really effective way. And one answer, you know, might be that Africa's youth are not as democratic as we might assume, right? I mean, you mentioned the latest round of Afrobarometer surveys, and fewer young people aged 18 to 25 said they preferred democracy to any other form of government compared to other age groups. So people who are older actually prefer democracy more. And I think an answer to that might be because their older age mates have experienced military or one-man rule, and they've roundly rejected that. And many of today's youth across the continent haven't experienced that. You know, they may have heard stories about it, but they haven't experienced it firsthand. I think another reason why is that young people face an uphill battle in many ways, right? Youth in Kenya and elsewhere lack the resources and social status. Young people are less likely to be on the electoral register and thus turn out to vote. It's hard to get their voting materials in order, many of whom in Zimbabwe, for example, is a great case in point, where people who are born today don't get birth certificates if you're born in an opposition area. So it makes it impossible for them to register to vote. So across the continent, you're seeing powerful political actors demonstrating the routine capacity to co-opt and demobilize potential youth challenges. And that, of course, includes the use of violence, harassment, and intimidation. So I think there are certainly many challenges, but, you know, the larger point is, and I think so often we talk about democracy and voting in abstract terms, right? And people, particularly youth, will say, you know, why is democracy important? Why should democracy matter to me when I'm hungry? Why should democracy matter to me? Why should voting matter to me when I can't put food on my table, or I can't get a job, or I can't access basic resources? Well, there are some pretty simple, straightforward answers. First and foremost, you know, democracy has been shown to improve a nation's overall health. Study after study shows this, and this is because democratic governments are inherently more open, they're more accountable and transparent, they're more protective of media freedom. And overall, this enabling environment allows leaders to be more responsive and use feedback to improve the quality of services, to meet the needs of citizens. Interestingly, democratic nations are also more likely to increase their own spending on basic resources and healthcare in the long term. And of course, this benefits everyone. Secondly, you know, there is strong evidence, report after report will show this, that democracy leads to stronger economies. And I think this democratic advantage needs to be broken down and explained to youth populations better. Again, not talking about democracy in abstract terms. Third, you know, really interestingly, states that hold free and fair elections and leaders who abide by basic democratic principles are inherently less corrupt. Therefore, there are more state resources to meet the needs of citizens. They're also better positioned to prevent non-state violence, including acts of terrorism. So, you know, really, we have to do a better job, and this includes me and people who work in my field. We need to do a better job of breaking this down and explaining it, because the evidence is clear. You know, positive development outcomes, if we can use that term broadly, are dependent on democratic foundations, and that includes free and fair elections. So I think, you know, people in the development world, people in the democracy world, donors, Western governments, but also governments in Africa and elsewhere, they should take this as an excellent excuse to add democracy promotion to their agendas, to their portfolios. I think we need to destigmatize this notion of democracy promotion, right? And really talk about the dividends of that and how it actually benefits citizens. And until we do that, I think we'll just continue talking past one another and continuing to see youth apathy rise in Kenya and elsewhere. And of course, this is not isolated to Africa. Again, this is a worldwide phenomenon.
Of course, yeah. No, definitely. Thank you so much for sharing that. And it's one of the conversations I've been, you know, sort of thinking about in terms of how to navigate this, because it's obviously left to this idea of, you know, civil society organizations, and NGOs usually take the onus on that. But it's like it's a concerted effort that requires as many people as possible, because people don't know what they don't know. And this idea, sometimes we say it almost flippantly, but I think it's a really huge point, right? People don't have certain memories, right? Living memories of certain experiences from the past. And so it's easy to almost want to try that, or to almost think, you know, that alternative might be better. But it's like, we've been there, we've done that, the track record exists, but people don't know what they don't know. So I definitely agree with you in terms of the amount of work that needs to go into this, the amount of work that we need to do around the speaking the language of a lot of Africa's youth, to try to get them to understand, to participate, and also, you know, to help chart what we want, you know, the future of democracy, which is now, to look like for us all. That was just a very interesting point, so thank you for speaking on that. I think we're coming to the end of this podcast, but I just wanted to ask, Jeff, if you had to speak to, you know, African people, let's say 35 and under, lots of whom you work with, and try to get also your work to, what would be one message that you would give or you would say when we think about the future of democracy on the continent? What would you want people to think about, to remember, to ponder on?
You know, I think it goes back to the topic, the point that we were making at the outset of this conversation, and it's about solidarity. You know, I really think at the end of the day, it comes back to that. And, you know, so often, of course, I have to be self-critical here as a white American male sitting here in Washington, D.C. I know people will get, you know, they get precious about this notion of meddling, you know, outsiders meddling in the affairs of other countries. But the truth is that international solidarity and cooperation has contributed to the fall of repressive authoritarian regimes throughout history. And for us to not acknowledge that is a detriment, not only to ourselves, but to those living around us globally. Peace studies, for example, recognizes that international cooperation and solidarity are essential, though of course not sufficient, to contributing to peaceful political change and to contributing to democracy. So my message would be to expand your networks, learn from people and other youth activists in other countries. Look at the tremendous work that the Not Too Young to Run campaign is doing in Nigeria, you know, getting young people involved in the political process at an early age, giving them the skills and getting them interested to run for office. And if you look at the success and the standard that they have created in Nigeria, you know, I think that certainly bodes well for the future of that country. And given the importance of Nigeria for the region writ large, you know, look to, for example, what happened in Zambia. Again, I'll mention this, the election there last year and the massive voter mobilization effort that was undertaken for Zambians under the age of 35, and the fact that they came out in droves to vote for democratic change and to vote for now President Hichilema. Another example is, you know, going back again, I mentioned this previously to the Gambia in 2016, and the fact that, again, youth came out in the thousands. You know, Gambia is a very small country, so they're not in the millions, but in the thousands to reject dictatorship, to reject one-party rule. And you see the spillover effects that has, and how that inspires people across borders, and how it inspires people like me, you know, living in the United States to energize my fellow Americans to vote and to not give up on you know, America's democratic experiment. So I think, yeah, quite simply, it's about cross-border solidarity. Boundaries are only in our minds. They exist in theory, not in practice. And I think that sort of cooperation is so crucially essential in building those relationships and building those networks of solidarity, especially amongst the youth who will pick up the torch from us and carry that on, I think is so important, because it gives them a sense of meaning, of impact, and the fact that they don't feel alone, that there are other people just like them across the world going through similar struggles and succeeding despite all the obstacles put in their way, and to not be dejected, to not be downtrodden, because there are multiple examples of successes. And I think we have to celebrate those small wins and those small successes, and we have to keep that momentum moving forward. So I think all of that is related. So that would be my message.
Jeff, thank you so much. It's been wonderful having you on the Brentus Foundation podcast and to sharing your insights. And I'm glad that, you know, even as we're talking about this, even this process of having this conversation is part of building that network of solidarity among different kinds of people across the oceans and in different parts. So again, it was absolutely lovely seeing you in Kenya, and I'm glad we had a chance to have this conversation here.
Absolutely. The pleasure was all mine, and thanks for having me, and definitely looking forward to keeping in touch and to talking about these important issues that mean a lot to me, and I know they mean a lot to you as well. So thank you for the opportunity.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrentusfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brentus Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.